Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow the experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from the studios in rain-drenched Thunder Bay, Canada, in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's Crime Beat broadcast presents Mr. William Deere, author of the best-selling book titled O.J. is Innocent, and I Can Prove It. In his new book, William Deere brings a fascinating new twist on the O.J. Simpson and the 1994 murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Rob Goldman. We'll bring you that interview in just a few minutes. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director-publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. He's all over the place, this guy. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is just released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out next year. This summer, he'll publish another book about the famous Gondola shipwreck on Rossport 100 years ago on Lake Superior. It went down. Willie will also be appearing at the Squashberry Writers Festival on Friday, July 29th to July 1st in Geraldton, Ontario, to talk about our show. Willie?
Great. Thanks for that, Ronnie. Appreciate it. We're going to have a good turnout, I'm sure. We're looking really forward to that. Well, Ronnie, I'll tell you something. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like hot tamales. We're almost sold out, and thanks very much again for the good word. Now, it's going to be a great show, so we invite our listeners to stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank our listeners out there from around the world. That's from around the world, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments, and not so many. We've had a couple of thumbs down, but we'll take the good with the bad. You know, we're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week, so I'll tell you something, internet radio is the place to be. I'd also like to thank our production people, Corey and Tony and Scott, for making this show possible. Also the Ryan brothers, who've supplied us with their music for our theme song. Well, Ronnie, here's this week's mailbag. Now, this one's from Lisa of Naples, Florida, who writes, Karen Gravano showed a lot of maturity and shared a great philosophy on life on your show last week. Being the daughter of a hardened criminal and murderer, Sammy the Bull Gravano, is not easy. Her book is movie material. I'm also a fan of Mob's Wives, and Karen's quite the entertainer. Now, here's one from Samuel of Haifa, Israel, of all places. Samuel writes, Sammy the Bull Gravano was no choir boy. His daughter, Karen Gravano, talks about him as a good father. I don't buy that for one second. Her father deserves to rot in hell for an eternity for all the murders he has committed. Well, pretty strong, Ronnie. Any comments?
Yeah, our listeners continue to have very strong feelings about some of the subjects we have on. You know, the book Mob Daughter by Karen Gravano is one of the better books that I've read about mafia, written by a family member. And of course, we were both impressed by how articulate she was.
Absolutely.
And how honest she was about her father, you know, and she seems to come to it. You know, as far as being a cold-blooded killer and a good father, we got all kinds of examples. You remember Al Capone's grandniece talked about Al Capone, how much the family loved him and how kind he was to the family. And we had Linda Scarpa, remember, the daughter of Greg Scarpa, the Grim Reaper, who killed several people, and she did the same. So it's not unusual.
Yeah, well, once a father, always a father, as far as their kids are concerned. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show?
Yes, next week we got Terry Taraba, who's going to talk about her book. It's going to be a real fascinating show again. Mickey Cohen, the life and crimes of L.A.'s notorious mobster. And she's going to take us into the L.A. underworld and its connection with Hollywood. And Mickey Cohen, you know, is a very, very interesting character, and it's going to be a great show.
I'm telling you, I'm looking forward to that one. He was quite the guy. L.A. Is well represented on mobster side with Mickey Cohen, let me tell you.
Right.
Now, give us an idea of what you've been up to, Ronnie. Where you been? And where you going?
Well, Philadelphia this Saturday. Our documentary, Frank Matthews' story, is going to be screened at the American Museum of African American History on Art Street. And if you're in the neighborhood, we welcome our listeners to go out and see it if they haven't seen it already. And the documentary won a Silver Ace Award from the Las Vegas International Film Festival last week, so we're really proud of that. And we've got it entered in some other film festivals, and hopefully we'll have more good news in the future. Willie?
Well, way to go. Congratulations, Ronnie. Like I said, buddy, you're going places, even at your advanced age. Good for you. Well, Ronnie, as you know...
I can't remember anything, but I'm going places, right?
Okay, you got to buy a ticket, you know that. As you know, Ronnie, as you know, the Beat to Crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime, and crime news you might have missed. Now, here's this week's rap sheet item number one, July 18th, 2012, Miami, Florida. Disgraced ref Tim Donaghy wins $1.6 million in his lawsuit. Hey, Ronnie, Tim Donaghy, the NBA referee who went to prison after gambling on games, has won a major money in a lawsuit. He received $1.3 million. Hey, what's your take on this?
Yeah, well, remember, he was on the show. We had him on the show, and he was talking about his career, and he really needed the money back then. He couldn't get a job and everything. And we had, remember, Sean Griffith on, who said essentially everything that that Tim Donaghy told us was a bunch of bull. But he got $1.3 million. He claimed that the publisher, and this is a word of warning to all you writers out there, the publisher ripped him off $250,000 in revenue. And unfortunately for Tim, the company's bankrupt, so I don't know if you ever see any of that $1.3 million. And the judge is going to review the award, so it may come down a lot. But, you know, he needs the money. He seems to have turned his life around, but he's not a very popular guy because of his shenanigans with the NBA and the scandal he caused.
Well, he's got a long history on gambling. Hopefully he doesn't put any of that 1.3
I hope he got over
on the opposite team that Miami's playing for the NBA title.
Yeah, tonight, let's go Oklahoma sink their ship tonight. Anyway,
it's going to be a good one there. That'll be a good game. Well, now, rap sheet item number two, Dateline, June 17th, 2012, Rialto, California. Rodney King found dead in swimming pool. Rodney King, whose police brutality case in 1991 led to deadly riots in Los Angeles, was found dead in a swimming pool on Sunday in Rialto, California. He was 47 years old. And police say there were no signs of foul play. This is a really sad one, Ronnie. I'd like to have your comments on that.
Yeah, this is really weird. We were in the process of getting him for our show. You know, it was very unfortunate to hear the news that he passed away. You know, he was a symbol, but he had a lot of problems. And he got some money for those beatings by those four white cops, over $2 million. But I understand he lost a lot of it. Through bad investments and continuing problems with the law. But, you know, I like the guy, and he said one of the, you know, he'll be immortal for that one line, right? Can we all get along?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one
that's
of the
right.
lines of the 20th century. So we hope he rests in peace. And
absolutely, yeah.
End of an era.
We're sorry that he's gone. He would have been a great guest on our show. Now, just before we get on to our special guest, we'll take a station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening, so if you've missed one, you can check us out anytime. If you have any questions for our guests, you can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Bill Deere, author of his explosive book titled O.J. is Innocent, and I Can Prove It. Mr. Deere makes the controversial but compelling case that it was, in fact, the overlooked suspect, O.J. Simpson's eldest son, Jason, who committed the grisly murders. Mr. Deere now compiles more than 16 years of investigation by his team of forensic experts and presents evidence that O.J. was not the killer. It's going to be a great show. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Bill Deere.
Thank you very much.
Great. I tell you, when I got this book, I looked at it, it's 500 pages.
And
I said, I'm going to have to read 500 pages about O.J. Simpson. But once I got into it, I just kept turning the pages. And I tell you, I assume you wrote it yourself, so it's a good book, and you're a good writer.
Well, thank you.
I'm sure it struck a raw nerve, because O.J. is one of the most reviled figures in recent American history.
Well, what's really amazing about this is that the reviews have been fantastic. We even did Bill O'Reilly. We've done 137 radio shows. We've only had, I think, as you said earlier, you're always going to get a few. We had about five or six. We checked on those, and those happened to be friends. Majority of them were friends of our suspect.
Right. Well, what's interesting is that you're a real seasoned investigator. I ran across a quote. Some newspapers called you the real James Bond, which it's a good thing to have on your resume, right?
Well, it's nice because of the fact that when I was doing a couple of cases in Europe, particularly in London, they gave me that because of the involvement I was involved in the Jack the Ripper reconstruction. And so they gave that to me, along with the fact that I've worked some of the most famous murder cases, kidnappings around the world, and have for nearly 45 years.
Well, I know your career is just amazing. You were appointed by the court to lead the exhumation of Lee Harvey Oswald's body. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was standing there 20 years prior to that when President Kennedy drove by, and I saw something happen that was not in the Warren Commission report. And I couldn't believe that it would be left out. And there was a car that suddenly pulled out of the side street, and it was a convertible, and on the back was a wagon, had an outhouse that said impeach or Warren, which at that time was our Supreme Court justice. And I thought, oh, my God. Well, as he passed, and he couldn't have been more than 20, 30 feet from me, I said, thank goodness. Well, then 5 minutes later, as you know, he was killed. And then 20 years later, I was asked to exhume the body of Oswald.
So what happened? Well, did you end up like Geraldo, you remember?
Well, no, I was very lucky on that one. We did this on a Sunday morning during the Dallas Cowboys were going to be playing the Red Raiders, whatever, I don't remember. But I told somebody, I said, let's hope we end history of this. The speculations have always been that the body in the grave will not be Oswald. As you know, the Russians were very good at plastic surgery during those times. And then when we finally went down into the gravesite, we were told it was a metal casket, turned out to be a wood casket. The body was badly deteriorated, but we were looking to see whether or not the head was still attached to the spinal column, and it was. And that was the speculation that it would not be. And we took the body over to Baylor Hospital and then performed the autopsy. And with certain records that we had that nobody else had access to, we were able, with Dr. Vincent DeMaio and Dr. Linda Norton, to determine that it was, in fact, the real body of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. On that, I guess you disappointed a lot of conspiracy theorists, right?
I'm sure even Marina Oswald was standing at quite a distance away. But when we finally got the body out of the ground, it was early that morning, and I'll tell you what, when you looked up and saw thousands of people pushing against the cemetery fence and actually pushing it down, so when we left very quickly with a police escort and all en route to Baylor. They pushed it down, and some of them actually even jumped inside the grave to get pieces of the wooden casket.
Wow. Turned into a media mania. But you were involved with O.J. The case, of course, and it's 17 years?
It's 18, believe it or not. It's 18 years this month.
18 years on that. What happened when he was found innocent? Were you one of the people that initially thought that he probably committed the murders?
Well, when I first started with this thing, I was speaking from the International Council of Reporters and Editors at their annual conference in St. Louis, Missouri on the 17th of June, and somebody asked me when it was over, and what I thought, and I said, oh, just something concocted by O.J.'s lawyers. It'll go on for hours and hours, and they'll scream and holler later that he couldn't get a fair trial because of publicity. But my sons, I raised two sons, and one of them said to me, he said, Dad, you're assuming he's guilty. And I said, well, look at the evidence. And he said, Dad, you make me put these signs up when you teach homicide to law enforcement and to investigators and attorneys and all. Never assume and always verify. And as a result, that began my 18-year search for the truth, because within a few days, I flew out there. I placed myself in the same time period that they claimed it happened. On a Sunday night, I waited till traffic was gone. We walked around the back. I left one of my men up front there to watch just in case I got arrested. Climbed over that back gate, walked that walkway, sat at her front door, as I've done on many, many cases, and tried to place myself in the mind of the killer. And in doing so, I realized that O.J. had been at the crime scene, but after the murders, and that he had to be protecting someone. And as a result of that, that started my investigation. And again, it was my nickel. It's been my nickel from day one through today.
Right. And you were a pretty lonely voice in those days, right?
It still was. Even
unless you were black, because I know a lot of my black friends thought that justice was served, and he was innocent, and
right.
he was being railroaded. By the L.A. police, whose reputation was pretty bad.
Well, when you look at all the things, Ron, that I uncovered, I mean, I wrote the first book about 11 years ago, and I wanted to end it. I really did. I did everything I possibly could. LAPD wasn't interested, attorney general, district attorney. So I put it down, and I said, all right, it's going to be like a fishing book. I'll pay for it. I put it out there with all the things I'd uncovered, and I said, now, if I get some really solid information, I'll continue. If I don't, it ends it. Well, within 2 weeks of it coming out, I get the first phone call that said, Mr. Deere, I have what you need. What is it I need? I have an altered time card by O.J.'s son, Jason, for the night of June 12th. And I want to show it to you because, of the fact, I felt from the very beginning that O.J. wasn't guilty and that they needed to be looking at another suspect, and that's primarily the son. You have to understand that the son, Jason Lamar Simpson, at the time of the murders was 24 years old, 5'11", 235 pounds. On Sunday, June 12th, he was the acting chef at a restaurant called Jackson's.
Restaurant, right?
Beg pardon?
Jackson's Restaurant.
Jackson's Restaurant that's located in Beverly Hills. Normally, Alan Ladd Jackson would be the chef, but on this Sunday night, because business being slow, the sous chef took over. But yet the LAPD had given our suspect an airtight alibi that he was cooking in front of 200 people on the night of June 12th. So when I finally went through all 12 people that I felt could be major suspects, I ended up at Jackson's Restaurant one night with my people who worked for me. And then I found out that the restaurant didn't even hold 200 people. And on the night of June 12th, they only had 30 to 40 maximum the entire night. The grill was shut down early. And the sous chef, the acting chef, our suspect, left about 55 minutes prior to the murders, very upset to the point that his girlfriend was crying. And that raised a major red flag for us. Why was she crying? Why was she upset? Then we find out that LAPD never interviewed our major suspect. Now, keep in mind that our suspect had been arrested and was on probation at the time for assaulting his previous employer with a knife. The charges were lowered later, but he was also charged with assault to do bodily injury. Third charge, assault. Well, these are certainly major flags. You have an individual who at the time of the murders was on probation for the original arrest of assaulting his employer with a knife. Now, how was the murder committed? With a knife. Well, that again is a red flag. Why didn't the LAPD ever interview him? Yet they had tunnel vision, even though the chief of police made a statement, we're going to look at everyone. Well, they didn't. They looked at O.J. Simpson. I've never met O.J. Don't care to. Could have. Didn't. I chose, when I wrote this book, O.J. Simpson, I can prove it. I wanted the investigation to stand alone so that everything that I put in this book was documented, and it has been, and the reviews, including even Kirkus, has said so.
Right. Yes, Kirkus is a very respected library, a reviewing medium, and reviews serious books, so they must have thought your book was serious. Yeah, you gave some interesting details. Well, Jason, let's fill in the picture of who this Jason is. He's the eldest son of O.J. Simpson, right?
Right. O.J. was married twice. The first marriage was to Marguerite, his college sweetheart, and as a result of that marriage, there were actually three children. One, there was Arnell, the oldest, then Jason, and little Aaron, who drowned when she was 23 months old in the Rockingham pool. That was another major red flag for us. We found that our suspect was supposed to be watching her at the time, walked off, and left her by the pool. She then fell in the pool, rushed to the hospital, and was pronounced dead.
So you think there's some hanky-panky with that death?
I'm not sure, although I do know that he had a lot of problems after that occurrence. I know he was very jealous from what we've been told by friends and associates of the little girl because he was wanting a lot of attention by his father to the point that his father said in Sports Illustrated, I'm having trouble with my son. It even went to the part that when he was 14 years old, he overdosed and was rushed to the hospital and admitted that he had been taking a numerous amount of drugs, alcohol, abuse of mushrooms, cocaine at 19 years old. Now, that's the second time you're being rushed to the hospital. I mean, you've got to know that when you're interviewed by the acting physician, he's going to make copious notes. And in his notes, he says, quote, you know, this is a problem. This young man has suffered all these problems here, that he's also suffering seizures. Now, he was taking, and we were able to verify this, he had been assigned by the hospital to take Depakote to control a rage disorder. Now, it's also for epilepsy, as a lot of people know, but it's also used to control intermittent rage disorder. He'd continued to take that for a period of time, but just 2 weeks prior to the murders, he had quit taking that, according to his girlfriend. In fact, that girlfriend was present when he attacked his girlfriend at that time, at a party for his 24th birthday where she saw it to us. She went up and spoke to Jason and gave him a little kiss on the cheek and said, happy birthday. And the girlfriend, Jennifer, became irate and ran. And as a result, Jason ran after her, pulled her out of a car. And according to the article, it appeared 2 weeks prior to the murders, he tried to choke her. And she made a statement that was supposed to be quoted. I thought he was going to choke me to death. When I interviewed the previous girlfriend, he said, or she said to me, she said, you know, he has a violent temper. He sometimes flares off. He took and put me down on the floor when I was late coming in from work, took out his chef's knife and cut off all my hair. Another time he picked me up and threw me in a bathtub that had no water and it nearly broke my back. Three attempted suicides, one where he stabbed himself with scissors in the stomach. He overdosed. Another one where he took some glass and cut his wrist. A young man who'd been in the psychiatric unit, Cedars-Sinai Hospital, where his father visited while he was committed to the hospital.
Yeah, hey Bill, you know, I got a quick question relevant to that. You know, you brought up some really compelling points about Jason and his really sordid background. Why on earth didn't the LAPD interview the guy? This is dumbfounding.
Well, you know, I've been in law enforcement. I've been inducted in the Police Officers Hall of Fame as a private investigator, so I'm pro-policeman. But I could not even understand this. I mean, this rush to judgment. Let's examine the pair of socks. Remember that he had a light beige carpet, O.J. did, in his house in Rockingham. There was no blood going up the staircase, and yet in that bedroom was a pair of socks. But look at the socks more closely in what's now in evidence. The pair of socks that was lying at the foot of the bed, which some people say were placed later, contained blood from the coal and O.J., but the blood was mixed with EDTA. Now, that's a blood preservative for people your listeners to understand that when you go to a doctor and they draw blood, they usually put it into a vial with a purple cap. It has crystals surrounding it, and they shake it so that it'd be preserved well enough for testing. But yet the blood on the socks found in OJ's house contained EDTA. The second portion was that the blood went from side to side, which means it could not have had a foot in it when the blood was applied. And then one of the top medical doctors in the world said that blood had to come from a vial of blood. We knew that when OJ got off the plane, went to Rockingham, he was handcuffs taken off, but he agreed to go down with Detective Van Etter Lang. When he went down to the jail to give a statement, they asked Thano Pritis, one of the nicest men I've ever met, the registered nurse at the time, had been there 30-some-odd years. He said, I was asked to draw blood. I did. I put it into a vial that contained EDTA, and normally I would send it to the crime lab, but Van Etter asked for it and put it in his pocket. And I asked him, I said, well, how much did you draw? He said, I drew 8 cc's of blood. But when Van Etter turned it in later that day, it contained only 6.5.
What happened to the other?
What happened to the 1.5? Was it the blood that was dripped from a vial of blood onto the socks? Now, again, when I did the first book, a second phone call came in, and it was similar to the first. Mr. Dear, I have what you need. What is it I need? I have your suspect's diaries for 91, 92, and 93. And I had him send me copies because I had his Jason's penmanship. I had it checked, verified it was, flew out and visited with him. And he had a box that he had found in a storage, bought from another man who bought it at the storage facility called Public Storage. A lot of people know storage wars. Well, when these things come up for sale, people buy them. Well, in this particular case, the man bought it and sold it to our person because he does not collect memorabilia. And when he looked inside the box, there was a lot of things that were, to me, really important. There was over 100 pictures, but one particular picture stood out to me. It was a picture of our suspect in bed with his dog wearing the knit cap, which looked to be the same knit cap found at the crime scene at Mundy. We blew it up, and it looked exactly the same. Now, we know that the knit cap found at Mundy contained hair from an Afro-American and from a dog, and they were not OJ's. The same as the skin underneath the closed fingernails did not come from OJ. Now, in addition to that, there was a subpoena by Christopher Darden for Jason Simpson's medical records. But the bottom of this box, which contained, it was just a small box, but had it like his whole life in it, had his dog's ashes, had the death certificate from little Aaron. The bottom of the box, though, contained a knife. A knife which was considered a boot knife. We then extracted the knife very carefully, found that the top had been removed, took it to one of the top experts in the country, Gerber, who said it was a replica of the Gerber Mark I, designed for one purpose and one purpose only, to cut and to kill, except the top had been removed. We then took it to Dr. Vincent DeMaio, the author of Gunshot and Knife Wounds, the Bible book of the industry. He examined the hilt of the knife and compared it to the autopsy photographs of Nicole, and it matched. Now, that was a double-bladed knife that had been made razor-sharp on more than one occasion, and the initials had been scratched into the sheath, JS. And again, Dr. DeMaio said the same thing. The knife was designed for one purpose, and one purpose only, to cut and to kill.
Right. And so you presented this evidence to the LAPD again?
We tried, Ron, numerous times. We even met...
The way you explain it is very articulate, and, you know, if you explain like that, I mean, they would at least take a look. I find it hard to believe that they wouldn't at least take a look at...
Not interested. Not interested. Now, why would you not be interested? The same as we know that O.J. Simpson's in prison right now,
right.
Supposedly for an armed robbery, yet the judge gave him back the items that he took that belonged to him about 2 years ago. In addition to that, nobody else is in prison for that so-called escapade, but yet the man who put that thing together, Thomas Riccio, made over $100,000 off the tape recordings that he'd wired the room when he brought O.J. Simpson up, as well as bringing these two memorabilia dealers over from L.A.
Right.
to Las Vegas with the idea they were going to sell some stuff.
Right.
Sad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you have a lot... you know, that's just part of the evidence.
Oh, that's just a, I'm sorry, but just a tidbit of what I've done and been able to put together.
Right, you mentioned the emails from his former roommates.
Yes, even his own roommates.
They tell you.
Yes, even his own roommates suspicioned that they call him JJ. And they suspicioned other people that had known him for years. The one person emailed us a while back and said, you know, that he pushed another person out of the door of a, of his Jeep into a street. One other thing that was really important that's happened within the last 2 weeks, as a result of the book coming out, we get a call from the defense investigator that was hired to help on the Dream Team. I never could find out whether or not anybody had ever examined our suspect for cuts. And the investigator said to me, Mr. Deere, I did. I interviewed Jason Lamar Simpson just a few weeks after the murders. There was a bad cut on his right hand. It was covered up by a large ring, but was in the process of healing. I wanted to tell you this because I felt it played an important part in all the other things that you've been able to acquire. Yet LAPD and the district attorney are not interested. And to me, that's a great miscarriage of justice because it does not bring closure to Nicole's family or to Ron Goldman's.
Right. Well, you described the murder as a rage killing, right?
Right. If you remember that...
O.J. Simpson was known for his rage. I mean, that fits O.J.'s character as well. I remember the incident in Las Vegas you referred to in 2007 at the Dallas Station. I mean, the guy went crazy. I mean, over that stuff. So, you know, both him and Jason shared that, you know, that characteristic. They had this,
there was, except the one thing most of the time that O.J. would get upset would be on the golf course. O.J., you know, we even have our suspects beating up his father's statue with a baseball bat, his Heisman Trophy. You know, when you started looking at all this and realized that this was a rage killing by an amateur, and you look at our suspect and you look at O.J. Simpson, and comparing the two, you look at it and say, it doesn't even come close to looking at the items that we've been able to uncover in our investigation on the part of our suspect.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with this fascinating discussion about O.J. Simpson. And the book, O.J. Simpson is Innocent, and I Can Prove It, by Bill Deere. Go ahead, Willie.
You bet, Ronnie. What a great interview. You know, I think Crime Beat has a very special guest, and he's got a story, and a good story to tell, and hopefully the justice is played out. Now, at this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Our special guest this evening is Mr. William Deere, author of O.J. is Innocent, and I Can Prove It. Now back to Ron and William Deere.
Thank you. With Bill Deere. And Bill has a website, www.billdeere.com, so you can find more information about him. And I guess the book is everywhere, right?
Amazon? Yeah, it's on Nook. It's on Kindle. It's at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. It's all across the country. And what's interesting, I ended up getting two letters from a New York police lieutenant and another captain, and they said they could not believe the amount of evidence that we've been able to uncover that LAPD just doesn't care. In fact, we sent an email a couple years ago asking if we could meet with them, and they sent us back an email that said, O.J. Simpson murdered Nicole Simpson, Ron Goldman, jury found him not guilty, case closed. Well, for your listeners, there's no statute limitations on murder, and the case can be reopened at any time. And that's been my goal for nearly 18 years. Let's have a grand jury. Let's look at the facts. Let's look at the evidence, and then let the general public and that grand jury make a decision, which needs
say
to be
that, Bill. Is it still open? Is it still officially open by the LAPD?
Well, according to that before the show, and we didn't know. We hear that it's open. It's not open. Why would it be not open if he got off?
Well, that's it. If you look in the book, you'll see the letter from Ross Harning, the police officer right. who's in charge of public relations, who said case closed. You know, that's the same thing. When we met with the Attorney General's investigative staff, and you'll get a kick out of this. Those were the nicest people I ever met. For some reason, it was before Jerry Brown was filing for governor again. And he allowed them to meet with us. It was their special investigative branch. And we showed them what we had. and they were ecstatic over it. In fact, to the point that they said, don't let anything happen to this, all these facts and all this evidence. We'll help you. LAPD won't. And we'll let you know within 2 weeks. Well, that was during the OJ trial. Well, 2 weeks went to three to four, four to five. The verdict was in, and we get a little email that says, reviewed it, not interested, case closed. You get five and six of the top investigators who believe that we put together a very strong, not just circumstantial, but strong evidence, hard evidence, but yet later on, and then who files for governor of the state of California? Governor Jerry Brown.
Right. Well, the O.J. Simpson case, one of the most high-profile cases in American history, and they closed the case, you know, without, you know, even keeping it open for any kind of, I don't know. What's the motive behind that?
I wish I knew. I wanted to debate Marsha Clark and Christopher Dart, and I wanted to talk to, you know, have a debate between Van Etter. But Van Etter, I'm sorry to say, passed away a month or two ago. But you notice he made a few dollars off the book like a few others did. He and Detective Lang, who ended up selling their book rights. And look at Marsha Clark. She's made a lot of money. I think she was paid $3 or $4 million. Christopher Darden was paid $1.5 million, my understanding. So they all profited by it. But yet we did not get the real story. And we need to look at it, that it's there. It should be opened and re-looked at because, I mean, the evidence speaks for itself. Here you have the man who is the silent partner at Jackson's Restaurant, who even gave me a copy of the time card showing that our suspect had apparently pulled out his time card, hand wrote it in, and put it back in for June 12th, 1994. In at 2:30, out at 10:30. Yet our suspect has no alibi whatsoever for the night of June 12th after he left that restaurant. In his deposition, which was never taken, by the way, except in the civil trial, and he says in that he ended up taking his girlfriend home, dropping her off, and went home. Well, according to the girlfriend, he came up and stayed with her most of the night. Well, you can't have it both ways. And he also admitted in his deposition in the civil trial, the only deposition, the only interview, except for the defense investigator, that he was expecting Nicole Simpson, mind you, and an entourage of about 13 people to come to the restaurant at Jackson's where he was working that night. In his diaries, he says he does not like women to lie to him. It's the year of the night for me. And here we have a man who's the acting chef, not running up and down a football field like his dad, who's preparing for 13 people. His Nicole, the mother, her mother and dad, Justin, Sidney, and all the other relatives, including hopefully OJ, but she does not show up. What do you think that does to a person who's supposed to be taking Depakote to control a rage disorder, who'd quit taking it weeks prior to that? Look at some of the murders and some of the problems that have happened on airplanes lately on people who are bipolar. We have...
Bill, you know... Sorry.
Go ahead.
I understand that they didn't find Jason's blood at the crime scene, anything?
They never checked.
So that's another case of omission.
Absolutely. Jason Simpson, and we filed, listen to this one, we filed a Freedom of Information Act with the District Attorney Hodgman, and he emailed us back and said, we'll let you look at the photographs, but we cannot find the knit cap, we can't find the gloves, we can't find the clothes. But as soon as we do, we'll let you know, and you're welcome to examine it by experts, except for one thing. We found them. A few months later, we found them. They're in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the L.A. Police Department homicide, showing where they were being represented, and showed not only the knit cap and the glove that showed Bobby Kennedy's bloody shirt, which they were told to stop. And we have pictures of it. And yet, according to Hodgman and the DA's office, they couldn't find the evidence.
Yeah, Ronnie, I got a quick one for
Mr.
Deere again. You know, Bill, O.J.'s top-notch big-gun lawyers who were defending O.J. at the time must have known that Jason was a suspect. Or even they probably had an inkling that he did it.
Well, in Shapiro's book, he said, I thought that they should be looking at Jason Lamar Simpson, O.J.'s son, but he had, according to the LAPD, had an airtight alibi that's cooking in front of 200 people. Well, let me tell you, Detective Pietroni, when we filed another Freedom of Information Act, a nice detective there checked and found that Jason Lamar Simpson was never interviewed by the LAPD. He was being represented by an attorney and refused to cooperate. And guess who his attorney was? Carl Jones, one of the top criminal lawyers in Los Angeles.
Wow. Do you think that they had a vested interest in getting O.J., not because he had anything personal against him, but because he was such a high-profile celebrity, and that would be a notch in their cap if they could get somebody of this magnitude?
Well, you had an improper search and seizure, and I think that's one of the reasons that you found the bloody socks that suddenly had blood on them, that one picture shows no socks at the foot of the bed, the other one does. Now, let me also say this. There were five blood drops inside the foyer where O.J. would have come in. But they were from O.J. When thanoparitis examined O.J. on the insistence of Detective Van Enterlang, they found no cuts, no bruises on his knuckles, except for a cut on his left knuckle. He offered O.J. a bandage for it. He said, no, that's okay. I broke it when I pulled on a glass that I was drinking when I got the phone call. We know that the back gate, back fence, according to what I was told originally, it was a 6-foot chain link fence. It wasn't. It was 4 foot. And it was indication of being mashed down where somebody had jumped up and over. Now, remember, they found one of the gloves there, found one at the crime scene at Bundy, one behind there at Rockingham where Cato Kalin said he heard the three thumps. Well, I promise you that if you jumped up and over that, you're not going to be able to come straight down on a standing position. You're going to lose your balance. When you do, you're going to hit the back of the bungalow. Now, once that happened, then the limo driver said he saw a black male cross and enter from the back. Well, again, there's no doubt in my mind that O.J. Simpson was at the crime scene, but after the murders. And I'm going to tell your listeners something that I've not shared with anybody, to my knowledge. A man has come forward who does not want to become involved, nor his name mentioned, who claimed he was a private investigator, and he was parked at the intersection of Dorothy and the alleyway of Bundy, and saw a vehicle come in about 15 minutes after what they said the murders would have occurred, and in it was two people. And according to him, one was O.J. Simpson, and the other was Jason, his son.
Wow.
Holy man.
Now, what's interesting is, you know, O.J. always struck me as being a very narcissistic person. What kind of relationship did he have with you? Would he, you know, to go through all the stuff that he did to protect his son, who was very troubled, and caused him so much pain?
Well, I think he blamed himself, Ron, and Will. I think for a long period of time, because during the time he was growing up, remember that he was taken, and because he was little, they weren't able to have total control of him. He was put in the Army-Navy Academy. That's not the same Army-Navy Academy we think of, but it was a private school. And Jason really looked good. I mean, he excelled, but he also was taught karate and other things that have to do with military. We have a picture of Jason, excuse me, just after the murders, shortly after the murders, where he put on a lot of weight. And now, you know, when you look at him and you see the picture of him wearing not the black knit or dark knit cap, we have a picture after the murders of him wearing now a gray cap. But yet the pictures that we have on our wall in our crime lab show him wearing that knit cap that we believe was found at the crime scene of Bundy. But when you look at his diaries, you have to feel so sad, because in one episode, I'll just describe something real quick to you that I found in his trash. And it was a note. It was all wrinkled up and wet. But then we took it and flew it back to Dallas, and here's what it basically said. Dear Jason, there are three of us here that I know about. I want solace, work with solace, was a blank. Now I'm a failure. I cannot do anything right. I cannot learn from it all. I cannot remember. Alcohol is the root of all my shortcomings. I know I'm a good guy somewhere, but I cannot find him. My innocence is lost. My eagerness is gone. And most of all, my will integrity, blank absent. I do not know what to do. No, I do know what to do, but I don't have the will to do it. In short, I'm effed. I had so many plans, but now what? I cannot exercise the simplest deeds. Sober, walking on broken glass.
And of course, you verified that those were Jason's diaries. How did you verify the handwriting?
The handwriting. We used one of the top experts who had examined the time card.
Right. Let's take another break, and we'll go into the last segment. Could go on for a couple hours. This is really fascinating. Go ahead, Willie.
Absolutely, an intriguing and very fascinating subject. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Now back to Ron Chepsik and William Deere for the remainder of the program.
We're back with William Deere, the author of O.J. Simpson's Innocent, and I Can Prove It. The book is everywhere. We have a lot of international listeners, Bill. What about internationally? Have you sold the rights to any...
No, I have not. I've just, in fact, I made a partnership agreement with Skyhorse. I own all the theatrical rights, and I own all the other rights to the book, and hopefully I'm going to release it across the country, because in England they love... have great interest in this. Even in Japan and all those places are showing a great interest in the O.J. case, and have, as you know, for many, many years.
I remember O.J. running through airports.
That's right. I think they remember those commercials because I think some of them were done in China, Japanese. So,
right.
It's
right on that.
But when you look at his diaries and you look at this note and then you realize that this is, as I said earlier, a rage killing by an amateur. O.J. Simpson, a lot of people don't know this, but he actually, according to his doctor, would get woozy at the sight of blood. But we know that a knife is a weapon of choice. We knew in our first book, I thought that it could have been a chef knife, a chef's boning knife that might fit the criteria of the murder weapon. But then when all of a sudden we get the book out, we get the calls, we then meet and find and have this weapon and have it examined by the experts, we then feel that we have in our possession the murder weapon that was used to kill Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. In my crime lab at my ranch, I also have in my possession the Jeep that belonged to Jason Lamar Simpson on the night of the murder.
Right.
So
wow.
I've tried to go above and beyond. Again, I wasn't there and you weren't there. I wish we could have a little birdie on the wall that could tell us everything, but I really, truly believe in my heart, after 18 years of this, it's been my search for the truth, that I believe that I am correct, and I think the evidence speaks for itself. I have no problems anybody reading it. And again, 522 pages, there's a lot of pictures and a lot of documents so that it verifies all the statements that I've made.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, there's a lot of theories about who might have committed the murder beside O.J., and one interesting part of the book is you go through some of the other, you know, alleged suspects like Cowling, his very good friend, Marcus Allen, who was, you know, a rival for or alleged rival for Nicole's affection, and even mentioned a mafia figure. Right?
Correct, Joey Ippolito.
But you went through these figures, and you eliminated all of them, right?
I did, and in fact, we were talking to, I guess, yesterday about this. If O.J. Simpson suffered the kind of rage that the police department claimed he had when he attacked supposedly Nicole Simpson, if he had ever hit you, me, or her with an open hand as big as his fist, he would just break every bone in your face. But that's not the one thing that's important to me. The other thing that's important was the fact that after they divorced, O.J. visited his children. Nicole and him had a love-hate relationship. On one occasion when she lived on Gretna Green, which is the street one behind Bundy, O.J. went there, and as he did, he saw Nicole having oral sex with another man who happened to be running a major restaurant that has a great deal of questions in it. And at that point, if he suffered a rage, according to Dr. Lenore Walker, he would have gone right through that window or right through that door. But he didn't. He turned and left, and about 3 days later, he sees this man. He walks up to him, and he says, look, Let's get something straight. I love my two children. I can't tell you and Nicole what you can or can't do now in my life, but what I can tell you to do is not to do it where my children can walk out and see it. Do you understand that? And the man supposedly said yes. Now, if that was a man suffering from rage, I'd like to know what it is.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, what's Jason doing now, and have you ever tried to interview him?
I met Jason at a restaurant he was working. I never met him personally. I let him see me purposely because I want him to know, you know, that I don't intend to give up. The last I heard, he had moved out of Florida, then went back to Florida a while back, lost a couple more jobs. Now he's back in Atlanta. Supposedly, he's gotten married several years ago. On his Facebook, he shows a baby, but that's not his baby. That baby belongs to someone else. So we know that he goes from one job to the other, and as far as I'm concerned, he's still in need of a lot of help.
Why hasn't he, threatened to sue you? Or
well, if he does, I have the right to deposition.
Are you a lawyer?
And, well, if he wants to sue me, he has that right. But when he does, he better understand this. I have a lot of questions that my lawyer and I will put forth to him. And they're all in the book, plus some we did not put in that book. But again, I still consider him a suspect, a major suspect that was overlooked 18 years ago, and 18 years ago, and even today in 2012, 18 years later, a suspect that should have been looked at. I never accuse anyone of being a murderer unless I was there. I let a jury do that. In this case, the evidence must speak for itself. And that's the best I can do. And I hope and pray that people who buy the book and read the book and find it of great value will then put forth in emails and all to the police department asking for a special grand jury hearing. Then I will know that I've accomplished a great deal of money that I've spent and the 18 years of my life.
Have you investigated the current relationship between Jason and O.J.? Yeah, O.J.'s in prison now, of course, after the incident. Are they still in touch, or what's their relationship today?
I know that we found a note during our investigation that said where he was having his Depakote filled at Brentwood Pharmacy. O.J. has refused to pay this any longer. I also know that I have not been able to verify this, but I understand that he is not being visited by Jason, and he's doing his time. I'm certainly that it's hard for him. He's in his 60s now. He'll probably be in prison till the day he dies if this continues, but I hope, because I now know that this thing in Las Vegas, to me, was a complete setup. And I think that if they couldn't get him one way, they got him another. And I hate to admit that because, like I said, I've said it before, I'm pro-policeman. But right is right and wrong is wrong, and I hope they grant him a new trial.
Well, you obviously keep in close tabs on O.J. It doesn't sound like you think he's doing too well in prison. I think he's, was it 9 years? I think he had a
9 to 33.
9 to 33. So with good behavior, he could be out in 9. How is he doing, and have you heard any comments about your book?
I have had no response from him as far as my book. I do know that he, from my understanding, he's trying to help other prisoners. He's trying to help them, teach them, and work with them. So he's putting his time, well, as good as it could be. I think he's trying to do the best he can. Again, I've never met him. I know that everybody will say he's narcissistic, but I also know that he's a family man, and the people that I've talked to said the one thing that he would not do is to harm his family, and he would look out after Arnell, Jason, and Justin, and Sydney. And in my mind, I think he's probably done just that.
Right. Now, what about the Goldman family? I mean, he was
never heard from him.
The father was very, very visible, very vocal, very angry.
Yeah.
Have you got any response from him about the?
Not a word. You got to understand, he is so steadfast in his opinion that O.J. Simpson committed the crime. If he would read this and look at it with an open mind, but when you see the look on his face, I know more about Ron Goldman than what I have in the book, and I've chose not to go into it. But I knew a great deal about him. I'm sorry, no one deserves to be murdered. Nobody deserves, but when you have, and keep this in mind, Ron Goldman sustained 27 stab wounds. His knuckles were badly bruised. There would have been blood all over the assailant's hair, in his nose, in his ears, in his clothes, and in his shoes. But yet, when you looked at O.J. Simpson's Bronco that he was driving, there was no blood on the brake and no blood on the accelerator. And no matter what Marsha Clark has said, the total amount of blood in that Bronco would fit on my thumbnail. How in the heck would that, how could that even be the case? How could you even walk up a staircase with beige carpet and not leave some incriminating blood on the carpet? He certainly didn't have time to dispose of the clothes. You know, you had Alan Parks waiting to take him to the airport.
We're almost out of time, though, but I think this would make a great television show where you have the jury and you present the evidence. Maybe
see,
you can get some of that.
I think you're right, Ron. I think you will. If I could take this and present this in its entirety and let the people, have a 12-person jury, but have the people at home look at it and make their decision, wouldn't that be an interesting miniseries as far as bringing out the true facts of what really happened?
Well, we're going to have to stop over here, but we'll get you back on if that happens after that. And they did have a civil judgment, too, so maybe we can have something like this go. Thank you so much, Bill Deere. We run out of time, and a fascinating book. O.J. is innocent, and I can prove it. I recommend it. I think that whether or not you agree with Bill Deere, and I think he has a lot of good points, you'll like the book because it makes you think, and it shows you there's always another side to a legal question. In this case, the murder of...
Great. Thanks very much, Bill. You were a great interview. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, then, and we'll see you. Thank you so much.
Well, Ronnie, thanks for that, and thanks again to our very featured guest, William Deere. It was a fascinating interview, and we were just delighted to have him on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about the program tonight?
I learned to think because he's got a lot of really interesting new evidence, and the way he explains it in the book and the way he explained it on the show, I'm just amazed that the LAPD has totally cut him off and has refused to even look at the evidence. How about you, Willie?
Well, you know, Mr. Deere revealed that blockbuster news account about O.J. and Jason in that car. So we were right on the cusp of a great revelation by Mr. Deere.
Right.
Also, you know what? I learned Bill Deere presents a really astonishing theory. You know, long convinced of O.J.'s guilt, the world was shocked when the jury of the trial of the century read the verdict of not guilty. You know, I'm not too sure if O.J., I think his son has some culpability here, and it's a great book, and I urge all our listeners
to... look at the evidence, right? That's all we're asking.
Absolutely, yeah. And
this thing to build here, anyways.
Yeah, and he's taken 18 years to present a really great case. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat Gangster Nickname of the Month segment. Hey, Ronnie, remember this guy, Anthony Tony Ducks Carello?
How did I forget him?
Well, you know what?
I told me.
He was. Tony Ducks, man, I tell you, Tony Ducks. He was a New York City mobster and a boss of the Lucchese crime family. He earned his nickname because of his ability to duck subpoenas and convictions during his long criminal career. Poor guy died in prison hospital in 2000. Any comments on this guy?
Yeah, I just love those practical mafia nicknames, you know. You know, ducks in a row. The chin, because the guy has a big chin. I'm going to start changing my nickname, calling you Pierogies, because you love pierogies so much.
Okay, good. I'll call you Ronnie Cabbage Roll. How's that?
Hey, I love that. It has a nice ring to it.
It is. It's good.
It's
it suits you.
A little less bland and chips, you know, which is what
going on. It suits you to a T, buddy. Anyway, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for June the 28th. When our special guest will be author Tara Tariba, who will discuss her book, Mickey Cohen, The Life and Crimes of L.A.'s Notorious Mobster. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to all our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune it to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.